Greetings and good morning, Western Colorado. Thanks so much for listening to KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio. My name is Eric Gould. It's 8 o'clock, and here's your local newscast for Thursday, January 10th. Yesterday's opening ceremonies of the Colorado Legislature were marked by the typical pomp and circumstance as in years past. But even before it started, the 2013 session made history as one of the most diverse groups of lawmakers ever to gather under the Golden Dome. Benta Berkland reports.
Amid a light and jovial mood, 31 freshman lawmakers took the oath of office for the first time on Wednesday.
State your name.
Frank McKelvey.
Do solemnly swear.
Democratic Representative Dominic Moreno of Commerce City is one of a dozen mostly freshman Latino lawmakers. He's also one of 8 openly gay legislators, the most in state history.
The more diversity you have in representative government, the better decisions that are going to be made for the people of Colorado, because Colorado is a very diverse place, so it only makes sense that government also reflect that diversity.
Freshman Democratic Representative Joseph Salazar of Thornton is also pleased by the makeup of the General Assembly.
The beauty of it is that no matter how diverse the communities are, we're all impacted by the economy. So all of us, we have an idea of what we want to do in order to help generate jobs for everybody.
But Salazar says he won't shy away from the thornier issues that directly impact the Latino community. He wants to roll back what he says are strict immigration laws.
Some of the legislation that we had in 2006 during that whole anti-immigration fervor.
Lawmakers are also expected to once again take up a controversial measure that would lower college tuition rates for illegal immigrant students who graduate from Colorado high schools. The African American community also has greater representation at the Capitol. Freshman Representative Javon Melton of Aurora says he wants to focus on helping working and poor families. And Melton says he thinks the high number of black lawmakers is part of a growing trend.
I think on a national level, a lot of my colleagues and a lot of people around the state have just really been inspired by Obama and by that movement. And so they want to make sure that their voice is being heard. They want to have an active role in government. And so I'm really excited to see that change and that momentum.
Despite the celebration of diversity, Wednesday was a more difficult day for Republicans who lost control of the Colorado State House in November's election. House Minority Leader Mark Waller of Colorado Springs acknowledged the change in power during his opening day speech.
Titles and majorities may shift, but our responsibilities to our constituents stay the same. Mr. Speaker, I know you and the members of your caucus are here to promote the best policy for the people of the state of Colorado. And I want you to know that Republicans are here to do the same.
Lawmakers will tackle a host of hot-button topics over the next 120 days, such as oil and gas regulations, the death penalty, and gun laws. And Colorado's first openly gay speaker, Mark Ferrandino, got a loud round of applause when he made his push for the passage of a civil unions bill.
The political function of rights is precisely to protect minorities from oppression by majorities. In that spirit, we must acknowledge that all committed couples deserve equal protection under the law.
A similar measure narrowly failed last year and ground the legislature to a halt in the final days of the session. The 2013 bill has already been introduced in the Senate, and it's expected to easily pass the Democratic legislature. Next up, Governor John Hickenlooper will outline his priorities for lawmakers and the session. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
State regulators are preparing to investigate the air emissions connected to oil and gas development. The Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission held a hearing this week about changes to rules on setbacks and water quality monitoring. Testimony delivered at the hearing reinforced the widely held view that more, better science is needed on oil and gas emissions. According to the State Natural Resources Department, the project will provide information about how oil and gas emissions behave, how they travel, and their characteristics in areas along the Northern Front Range. A second phase would look at possible health effects. The State Health Department will contract with the Colorado State University to conduct the 3-year study, which will start in July. It will be funded by proceeds from oil and gas development, with an initial cost estimate of $1.3 million. Department of Natural Resources Executive Director Mike King says this study marks another step in the state's efforts to ensure oil and gas development and conduct it with the highest standards of environmental protection. Under the Hickenlooper administration, the state regulatory agency has continued to build upon oil and gas requirements. Last year, the state began requiring the disclosure of chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing fluids, added more regulatory staff, and opened its water quality database to public access on the internet. This week, the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission approved rules for mandatory groundwater monitoring and is also considering further limiting drilling near occupied buildings. Yesterday, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack designated nearly 600 counties in 14 states as primary natural disaster areas due to drought and heat. The designation makes all qualified farm operators in these areas eligible for low-interest emergency loans. Last year, the USDA designated about 70% of the United States as disaster areas due to drought. Agricultural producers in nearly two-thirds of Colorado are eligible for federal assistance to deal with the ongoing drought. However, none of the counties in the primary KVNF listening area made the list. Both Colorado U.S. senators welcomed the announcement and said it highlights the need for Congress to pass the Farm Bill, which includes resources to assist farmers and ranchers suffering from the drought. And now, KVNF's IC Change project explores how some of the tiniest life forms on the planet might help plants to manage water during times of drought and even contribute to the snowpack.
Last April, when I crash-landed in Paonia, Greg Cranson was one of the first farmers I met. He's the picture of a Western farmer with a handlebar mustache and a soft leather hat. But while most farmers I talk to say farming is a gamble, Greg relates farming to his faith.
They plant the seeds, they go into the ground, they disappear, I don't see them, and there's a transformation that happens when they go in the ground that I don't control. And so I have to have faith to believe that they're going to grow and mature.
As we sat together talking in his greenhouse, a gentle rain started to fall. Even back then, long before the summer drought, the sight of rain was a welcome relief.
It's great to see the rain. Boy, I hope it snows more in the mountains.
Greg has been farming in Paonia for over 30 years, and even though he's not an old-timer, he still feels the weather has been weird.
It seems like more and more we're having to day by day just walk outside and see what's happening and then be flexible with the extremes because it seems like things are getting more and more extreme.
He lists off a litany of changes: longer springs, later frosts, warmer falls. But the big changes he worries about is less snow in the winters, especially compared to the 80s and 90s.
Snowpack in the mountains, I think that's a real concern is managing the water. You can't count on it.
Now here's the part of the IC Change conversation where I typically ask,
what would you ask a scientist?
Good question. What would I ask a scientist? Well,
and here's where Greg threw me a loop. Instead of wanting to know about snow or water, he wanted to know
how the life of the soil cooperates together to support plant life. I've always been fascinated with the soil, and I've always been an organic farmer, so I am interested in knowing how God made it work.
I found two scientists at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory in Gothic, Colorado, who had interesting answers for Greg. First, evolutionary biologist Noah Whiteman wanted to be sure he heard Greg's question right.
Well, I think Greg posed the question in a more beautiful way than I'm going to pose it. But his question was somewhere along the lines of, how do the interactions between microbes and between microbes and plants sort of influence life for the plant, right?
I actually did ask Greg if that was what he was curious about, the secret life of bacteria and microbes.
Yeah, that's what I want to understand more, is how those life processes work.
Greg, I think that's a fascinating question, and it's something that I think about every day as part of my research. Plants have all kinds of microbes that they associate with in their roots, in the soil, and also in their leaves above ground. And a lot of these microbes are beneficial to plants.
Jennifer Rudgers, a researcher and biology professor from the University of New Mexico, studies microbial symbiosis, the close interdependent relationships between microbes and plants.
We think that these symbioses between microbes and plants may play a really important role in helping plants to adapt to changes in climate.
Over 80% of flowering plants have tiny fungi in their roots, and these fungi can help plants acquire nitrogen, phosphorus, and they can even help plants acquire water.
So if a plant can acquire a new symbiont that helps it do better under drought conditions, then that's a really quick fix to the problem of drought.
In long-term warming experiments at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory, Rudgers and her colleagues have documented increased numbers in the microfungi as a way that plants respond to warmer, drier conditions.
So that suggests that these associations may be more beneficial, that the plants may invest more in them. We may find that one of the best ways to manage plant response to climate change, whether it's a crop or a natural plant community, is to manage the microbial community.
And that's not the only way these tiny microorganisms may be managing water. Noah Whiteman also studies microbial symbiosis, but he looks primarily at the tiny interactions on the leaves of plants. One leaf plant pathogen he studies is called Pseudomonas syringae.
And it turns out that Pseudomonas syringae facilitate the condensation of water and increase the freezing temperature of water. So plant pathologists discovered this by noticing fields of plants that had frost damage and the temperature did not get down to frost levels. And that extends to the point where it's been used, it's called Snowmax, they're dead Pseudomonas syringae, or you know those big snow-making machines? They were shooting bacteria, dead bacteria, that contain this protein in order to facilitate the formation of snow. So Bill Hamilton had this idea that microbes, you see all the clouds above us,
yeah,
were manipulating the weather to their own advantage. And of course, that is a brilliant evolutionary strategy, going from, you know, middle of nowhere Colorado to middle of nowhere Russia, riding in the clouds would be a great way to increase your fitness. And so this is the bacterium that we study up here that we think is interacting with the plants to change the way the plants interface with their environment.
Noah says that we have much to learn about how these relationships play out, but that perhaps bacteria and plants are actually negotiating their environment much more than we imagine.
That's what's so fascinating about being with plants. They have this instinct and they're in touch with the environment.
And in many ways, when it comes to climate extremes, Greg is taking a cue from watching plants adapt.
So as the environment gets more challenging, it causes my faith to grow. I can grow. I can change.
I See Change is produced by Julia Kumari-Drapkin and brought to you by KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, and Localore, a national public media initiative produced by AIR, the Association for Independence in Radio, with financial support by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Wincote Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Our theme music was produced by Joe Allen and Issa Caress.
And that concludes your local newscast for Thursday. For KVNF, Mountain Grown Community Radio, I'm Eric Gould. Have a great day, everybody, and thanks so much for listening.